John, first off, morning, pal. Appreciate it, man.
I'm happy to be with you. Good morning.
You know, I was thinking about doing the interview this morning. I'm thinking, man, what a world we live in. I mean, think about it now. The Muslim mayor of London wants knife control.
Yeah.
The Pope says there's no hell. I mean, we're living in interesting times, at the very least, aren't we?
Well, we're living in the times that we were assigned to live in, and it is very interesting. I would guess everyone lives in what they see as kind of crazy times. But there's never a dull moment right now, especially if you're following international stuff, national stuff, local stuff. The hits keep coming.
Syria, it really comes to list in that respect as well, because the president is talking about, you know, as of yesterday afternoon, he was saying 24, 48 hours, we're going to make a decision. He was meeting with military leaders about a plan when it comes to Syria, and this latest, what is accused, a chemical attack, the Russians say, NIT.
Yeah, you know, I mean, even some of the stuff in your intro, you talk about, I mean, where's the world outrage? Here's a war crime, a leader obviously a dictator, using chemical weapons against his own people. I don't know. I'm not in the rooms and listening, but I think because of the last administration and there's a red line here, and that didn't really trigger any response, kind of observing President Trump, knowing that Obama didn't really respond, my guess is he's going to respond, and it will happen soon.
And there already was a response. And then some people saying the United States did it, a series of missiles sent into Syria in the wake of the chemical shooting, and Israel being the culprit, not widely reported here in the United States.
That world is a dangerous place, and I never argue against those people who want to protect their freedoms and their democracy, defending themselves against threats.
You know, and this is the other thing. When it comes to threats right now, John, over the years that I've known John, has stayed very active when it comes to Soviet bloc countries, what were used to be called Soviet bloc countries. You've been very engaged in that subject matter since day one as congressman, and we're looking at this in a new way now. We're at war with Russia in social media, with tariffs, and back and forth. As a matter of fact, the young girl that was released from British hospital now for the nerve attack. Are we living in a new Cold War, Congressman?
Yeah, I think we are. I mean, anyone who says that we're not, I don't know why we try to use semantics, but we are. I mean, Putin is a dictator, and he has seized sovereign countries. Obviously, parts of a country called Georgia, and we all know about Ukraine and the Crimea. We now, as Americans, understand their assault on our political system through social media, through Russia Today, through a very planned operation. He's been doing that to Eastern European countries from day one, and since I do follow that area closely, I can name the political parties he's funded, the candidates he's funded, the disinformation he's used. It's curious. I just think that the Russian mentality is that they want to go back to a strong leader in an empire. It's not just going back to the communist era. It's going back to Tsarist Russia. It's just they would rather give up goods and services for the individual citizen to have a strong autocratic leader. It's very curious, because the country itself would be much better off with free and open borders and the rule of law.
And what's interesting is the connection between the two items we just brought up, Syria and the Ukraine, and you talked about Georgia as well. In each case, the previous administration had said, here's a red line that cannot be crossed. And with Ukraine, it was literally treaties that we have that ensure the United States will help them defend against Russia. And you and I don't want to see any U.S. soldiers killed. We come right out and say that. We don't want to get out here and have a full-on with anybody right now or any other time. But there comes a point where commitments have been made, and when the United States does not respond to the threats that we've assured people we would help in this event, we set an ugly, dangerous precedent overseas that the United States, the people who live in this country, may not fully comprehend.
Yeah, and the people still look to the United States for kind of the rule of law, democracy, freedom, and those, and they and many parts around the world still do desire that. Ukraine's a perfect example. I mean, there is the eastern part that's been absorbed, and the Crimea has been absorbed into Russia, and then you have the eastern part that is held by Russian people who claim that they're Ukrainian. So, having said all that, we are now going to provide defensive weapons to the Ukrainian military. I mean, you eventually have to stand up to a bully. You just can't let a bully continue to operate. I mean, I thought it was very curious if you saw Rouhani from Iran, you had Erdogan from Turkey, and then you had Putin at a meeting. I mean, and I the most curious and frustrating thing is Erdogan, who Turkey being part of NATO, slowly aligning themselves with these dictators and thugs, and that affects the liberation of Syria in that aspect because of Turkey's ambition. So it is a very dangerous, confusing place.
Erdogan is one that when you mentioned that, you know, my first thought is, yeah. I mean, you've watched this move to an Islamist state is what I'm seeing develop there. I mean,
yeah, and I met some very great Turkish parliamentarians, retired army officers. We were very close to the Turkish people, so much in the old days that it would be the United States and Turkey kind of arguing with some of our European allies because they wouldn't let Turkey into the EU. And now look what happened. They didn't let them into the EU. They didn't get assimilated into the kind of a European economic market. And so they're looking for other places.
When it comes to the tax reform package recently signed by the Republicans without any Democrats, people are now coming out, number of sources, new things saying, look, oh my, we're going to our federal annual budget deficit will be $1 trillion in 2020. Is the tax reform, do we have to wait for the tax reform to have some type of effect? Is there a lag when it comes to hopefully business picking up and creating more taxes while the government takes less of them, but more activity? I mean, how should this be working in your mind, and what should we anticipate? Because a lot of people saying, look, we can't afford any more deficit. And some of those people, conservative Republicans, are saying we can't afford tax reform like this.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure who you're referring to, because the Republican conservative position is tax cuts are always good, and the response by the public and the manufacturing sector has been great. I don't think you can go to a corner of the country where you can't find a manufacturer that has either given bonuses, pay raises, benefit increases. 50% of all the manufacturers, 50% of all manufacturers in the country are announcing plans to grow. So if there's something bad about tax reform, it hasn't reached my desk, because it's all good. Now, did we leverage some $1.5 trillion to release this, hopefully, engine of economic opportunity? Sure. But we were in our growth was about 2%, 1.8% GDP. Now we're getting projections that we may be up at 4. If we do that, we're going to make that $1.5 trillion. That's going to be that's going to be in the bank. So I don't think our fiscal conservatives, and I'm one of them, I don't think it's tax reform that's got these people all fired up. It's our omnibus spending bill,
right,
in which we had to leverage $300 billion more in borrowed money to pay off Democrat senators. That's kind of how it went down. And did we want to go down to a shutdown route? And the spending bill was basically making our military whole. And now we just started this whole segment with the craziness of the world and military intervention and strength. where we were doing the opposite on spending. So we just had to fix that, and we're in the process of doing that, and that's why most Republicans voted for the spending bill, even though we got extorted by the minority Democrat senators who wanted more spending in other government programs.
Right. And one of those programs is the Senate portion of that omnibus spending bill. Sorry, my memory can sometimes elude me after I've read figures, and it's been a while, but I'm thinking last year's budget for the Senate was $43 or $44 million, and in this spending bill it's $919 million.
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't doubt someone who delves into the numbers that closely, but I'd be shocked if it was that would be outrageous.
Well, and see, what's interesting is they say they need the $919 million for financial tracking and additional computer systems, and I'm like, I can probably, you ought to talk to me, and we can negotiate a better deal. Hey, here's an interesting thing. I mean, when you think about this, Illinois taxes on the state level, all right? And we've seen what I call the Illinois exodus because it's happening in biblical numbers. All right, so what happens on the federal level when people continue to leave? We our representation stays the same in Springfield, but it could potentially change in D.C.
Oh, very much so. I mean, we've seen a lot of people, and this is the benefit of teaching history in high school, is there was one time I think Illinois had 26 members of Congress, 26. We're down to 18 now, and since I've been running for office, we've gone from 20 to 19 to 18. And definitely in the new reapportionment or redistricting, we'll easily be down to 17. Now, I represent 33 counties, which means in rural America, if you're just going to have to get more counties. That's issue number one, and how do people feel they're represented when you get your congressman who has to represent 40 counties or something. I mean, it's almost half the state.
Right.
Having said that, the real fear is that we're going to lose two, and we'll go down to 16, and that would be also challenging. And then you lose obviously leverage and strength in trying to do things that support the state of Illinois at the federal level. And the Republican delegation is very close. We meet frequently. We talk over issues and how we're going to vote. We make sure everybody kind of knows. Not that we don't vote in sync all the time, but we at least want to know so that we can help and support each other, and then we can work on each other's projects in their congressional districts. So you're raising a big concern, and that's why a lot of things are risen. You know, even that's why this gubernatorial race is important.
Yeah.
Not just for the congressional delegation, but also for the state legislative maps. We saw what happened when you had full control of the remap drawing process, and you've got these crazy districts that are there to just strengthen the Democrat control, even at the federal level through the congressional maps. We have to have a check and balance in that, and that's why Governor Rauner has to be successful if you just care about a fair map.
Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan yesterday filing a motion to defend the Affordable Care Act, along with other attorney generals from across this country.
to offend or defend?
Defend it, yeah, to defend and keep those keep the Affordable Care Act. We must protect the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I'm not sure it's a federal law, so parts of the Affordable Care Act are still part of law. What we were able to do was take away the individual mandate. We're allowing, some states are starting to move on their own to try to do short-term insurance plans. They're trying to do cross state line top issues. You do see some states who want to provide insurance coverage. I just had a long conversation with one of my constituents on his health insurance rate, and he's self-employed, and he is still getting stung pretty bad by that. And you know, I kind of went through this litany of things that was going on nationally, and these other options, and you know, his option to not get penalized if he doesn't want to buy and or he can't afford it. And it's really the working poor. I mean, those are the ones who are getting really messed over on this. It's not the poor. It's not the richer folks. It's the people who are doing well enough to pay their bills and get a little bit ahead, but they're being stung by this law.
Yeah. I actually, a man contacted me. He says, my new healthcare provider, there is no doctor, no hospitals that I'm authorized to see under my insurance plan. I have to drive to Harrisburg from Jackson County, to see a provider approved by my insurance company. He's working on getting that changed. Before I let you go, the election still fresh in our mind. When the primaries here, when I look at the incumbent, you've got John Chimkus. When I look at the two Democrats fighting over the primary, I thought Carl Spohr was a little closer to the center than Kevin Gaither. And what happened, Kevin Gaither wins. I see him farther to the left in that spectrum. But one thing the takeaway is now, it is very clear. It's not like there's a lot of overlap between you and your opponent.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what elections are about. I represent a very conservative area, both socially and fiscally, and middle class, the lower middle class, small town communities. And the Democratic Party is in their own throes of a battle between what we would know as conservative Democrats versus progressives or leftists. And you're right. There's a simple choice.
There's
a simple choice for the people of the 15th district coming up.
Just off the side of something I've run into is the number of coal mines in southern Illinois. And, well, I should say south central and southern Illinois that are looking for coal miners right now. I'm hearing more and more about that, by the way.
Well, and we never promised that we'd bring back the glory days. We did promise we would stop the war on coal, and I think we've done that. We're fortunate that we've stabilized the market, and we're fortunate that we're exporting coal. So those things are at least keeping us at least. That's always good news when people are looking. There's a lot of jobs out there.
There are.
We just got to have people willing to work. They got to be clean. They got to be willing to show up on time, and that's welfare work. Work and welfare reform issues that we have to deal with.
Hey, just before I let you go, it's a question that somebody asked me yesterday. I didn't know the answer because I know you know Prairie State Energy Campus. It's one of the locations I'm talking about looking for coal miners. There's a coal mine next to the power generation plants. Are those owned by one person, or is the coal mine owned by one group and the power generation another? How does it work? I was asked yesterday.
Prairie State owns both the mine and the power plant.
Oh, okay.
And so it's a very efficient operation, so it mines the coal and it ships it across the street into the power plant. And now that was started by Peabody, and then so to really, it's Prairie State is a standalone merchant plant, we call it, but it is owned by really public utilities, public power, either co-ops or municipal power.
Sorry I kept you so long, but I appreciate all your time, Congressman John Chimkus this morning. John, really do appreciate your time.
You always keep me on my toes. I enjoy it. Thanks.
Thanks, John.